What's going on, everyone? Welcome to Corner Table Talk, where we talk about things related to food plus drink plus culture. I am your host, Brad Johnson. My guest today requires no further introduction. I'm so pleased to welcome the incomparable Billy D. Williams. Billy, welcome to Corner Table Talk.
Thank you very much.
Nice to have you.
Nice to see you.
Thank you.
You have a wonderful face.
Thank you very much. It's lighting. Trust me, it's lighting, but I appreciate that. Before we get rolling, I wanted to thank a couple of people, Billy. Todd Gold, the journalist and author, has been a friend for years, and he was the first person I actually saw mention your book. I want to thank Todd for helping to arrange this, as well as Marcy Fine, who receives a glowing acknowledgement in your book, the recently released What Have We Here? Portraits of a Life, which we're going to talk about a little bit today. I had the pleasure of listening to the audio version, and I have to recommend this highly. To read it, I'm sure, is a journey as well, but to listen to it in Billy D's voice is just magical. Billy, I have a little thing I do called short order questions. It's a restaurant reference. I come out of the hospitality industry. So these are just a few little questions to get us rolling and get us started. You ready to go?
Yep.
All right. So tell me, what music are you listening to these days?
I listen to everything. From classical to the old pop stuff, the old standards, to even some of the stuff that these young people are doing these days.
Yeah, I heard you mention Childish Gambino when you were meeting with him over Star Wars, Donald Glover.
Right.
And I was surprised to hear that you took the time to listen to his music.
Oh, he's very good. I think he's very extraordinarily talented. Yeah, I love what he does.
I would agree. You're also an extremely talented painter. Do you listen to music, Billy, when you paint?
Yeah. Not always, but as a rule, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
But I also watch a lot of television when I'm painting.
Really? That's unusual. Not a distraction?
Listen, it's sort of whatever it is that I'm trying to express in the moment.
I'm originally from New York, but I lived in L.A. for 30 years. I loved when there's no traffic, certain drives in L.A. Do you have a favorite drive that you like in Los Angeles?
Well, I haven't been doing it any. I don't do it anymore. But I used to love to take long drives up the Pacific Coast Highway.
You know, yeah.
I would choose a weekend day and take these long drives.
Yeah. How about a cocktail of choice? Is there something that you like to sip on, a beverage, when the day is winding down?
Well, recently came up with one. It's a Tito's vodka in a wine glass with cucumber juice and ginger beer.
Wow.
It's pretty good.
Okay. That sounds delicious. I love the ginger beer touch.
Yeah, it adds just a little spice, a little sharpness to it.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so last one of these. How about your last great meal in a restaurant? I used to see you out occasionally at Le Petit Four and at Fred Siegel. I remember seeing you having lunch there, but anything come to mind?
Well, don't say last great meal.
No. Most recent great meal. How's that?
A recent meal. I like to go to several restaurants I frequent with my friends. One of them is Le Petit Four, right there on Sunset. I love escargot. So I love to have escargot in the afternoon with my special drink.
Yeah, that's a great setting on Sunset. It kind of captures everything that's cool about LA. You get a little low-key because you can tuck back, not really seen from the street, but you can see all the walk-by traffic, all the drive-by traffic. I love that room.
Yeah, Sunset Plaza, right. That's what I was
trying to say, yeah. So let's jump in here. How are you and where are you?
Well, I'm at home now.
It looks lovely. I want to reiterate, Billy, how much I enjoyed the experience of listening to you narrate the chapters of What Have We Here. It really it struck me deeply. And throughout the book, you talk about your admiration for Duke Ellington. And one of the times you happened to be in the dressing room that he was in, and you thought about different things you wanted to say. And what you ended up saying was something that made me want to relate this to you. You said, watch him, learn from him, appreciate him, and thank him. And that's what I wanted to say to you, Billy. I wanted to thank you because you've elevated the bar for our culture. And I thank you for sharing your story in this book. So I wanted to express that to you. That really resonated with me.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. You come across as always having been self-assured and aware of the effect.
I don't know about all of that.
Even now. And you don't take yourself too seriously. So
that
you go.
I definitely don't do.
You're modest and you're also astute. And there's a place in the book where you talk about being on Broadway and you're on stage. And of course, when you come out, the ladies go crazy. They're screaming. And Broadway's supposed to be somewhat subdued. But I guess when Billy Dee makes an appearance, that happens no matter where he is. But you notice a couple in one of the first couple of rows, and they're having a hard time. The woman is apparently either paying too much attention to you, and her husband seem to be having a difficult time.
She was hyperventilating.
Well, there you go. And you decided to direct the lines that you spoke in the play to the man. And that was a really interesting decision to make in that moment. And I'm curious, have you felt your presence make other men uncomfortable, or why in that moment did you make that decision?
You know, I was playing Dr. King, and I wanted to take me seriously, and I wanted everybody to know that I was very serious about giving a portrayal that was meaningful. So I decided to play the whole performance to this young man, and he really appreciated it.
What in his reaction told you that he was, that it was touching him, it was hitting home?
I think he understood, he realized I wanted to make a point that I was not there to take his girlfriend away from him. No.
Have you found yourself in those kinds of situations, Billy, where you feel like you go out of your way to make the man more comfortable because of the attention that you get from women?
I think so, yeah, because I understand all of that kind of stuff. I remember once in Chicago, I was leaving a hotel and I got into my car, and this guy opened the door and threw his girlfriend in the car and said, there, you want to see him? There he is. I was like totally stunned, but I really felt sorry for him. I mean, I understand that kind of reaction, but because I don't take it, not that I don't really take it seriously, but I don't play off on it.
Yeah, I was struck by your humility throughout the book. And again, the disarming part is you not taking yourself too seriously. I mean, clearly, you know, you descending the stairs and Lady Sings the Blues and that magical moment and the music. It's one of those cinematic moments that just stays with you. And you talked about that moment in the premiere. And how when you heard the audience erupt, you just laughed. You just thought it was hilarious. And I think that's cool.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I said, my goodness gracious.
How lovely. <You know? laughs> Is this all about me?
But I said, my goodness. I mean, they had with, what was her name? She was a beautiful girl. But nobody looked at her.
Looking at
they
you,
were looking
man.
At me. I thought that was that was hysterical. Yeah. But it was also the moment when I presented Diana with the $20 bill. It took me a while to do that scene because I was being treated in the way that the old movie stars from the golden age of movies was being treated, with special lighting and all that kind of stuff. And I was in hysterics before I could pull myself together.
I was a little surprised to hear how instrumental Berry Gordy was in a lot of the tone and importance of portraying you the way that you were as a handsome, dashing, leading man. But Barry had a big hand in both that and Mahogany.
You know, he's a product of those movies of the 50s. He was quite instrumental in putting it all together. The whole idea of creating memorable lines was something that was quite prevalent in the choice making of putting that movie together. You know, like in Mahogany, what was it? What's the name, famous line? Love is nothing without someone you love to share it with. I mean, that's right. An old adage. So, I mean, he was good at finding those kinds of memorable dialogue.
Yeah, that's what I find so culturally significant, and it makes perfect sense that Barry, coming out of the world of music and songwriting, where, you know, Smokey and those phenomenal songwriters he was around, he would find the place and the right words at the right time to come, you know, and be part of Black cinematic history. And it took a Berry Gordy, and it took obviously a Billy Dee Williams to be able to deliver that line and impact people the way that you did. But it was significant that Barry knew the culture and was able to put his finger on the pulse and deliver.
Playing Lewis McKay in Lady Sings the Blues, I did a terrible audition, and everybody in his team wanted Paul Winfield, who was to play the character, but he got real excited about me being at the chemistry that Diana and I had with each other. It was like a major discovery. You know, he ran up to me and he says, Billy, he says, look, you're Lewis McKay. You know, I just got to talk to these people, but you're Lewis McKay. And I love that in Barry. You know, he's like a mogul who's childlike. And it's beautiful. Yeah, it's a beautiful thing to watch.
Yeah, it's childlike. What a great combination. Billy, I don't know how it was lost on me as a native New Yorker that you were born and raised in Harlem, but I didn't know that. I was surprised to see that. But then so much of your swerve it's kind of self-explanatory. Then it's like, oh, okay, I get it. My dad was a little bit older than you. He was born in 1925, and although he was born in Hartford, Connecticut, he grew up, really came into his own in New York in the 50s and 60s and through the 90s. And he owned a restaurant on 95th Street called The Cellar. I don't know if you ever went to The Cellar, but that was my dad's place.
Yeah. I used to go there all the time.
Really? Oh, I love that. And although you were younger than my father, I can see my father was a huge Miles Davis fan. And before he bought the restaurant, he sold suits for Paul Stewart, who was actually the first Black clothing salesman that worked in that fine department store of Paul Stewart's.
You weren't a member of the Jack and Jill, were you?
I was not. No, I was not. And neither was he. I know you mentioned that in your book. You set a standard for Black elegance that my father personified as well as a restaurateur. And at points in the book, you talk about possibly being 30 years too soon, something along those lines. Was Hollywood intentionally not looking for opportunities for Billy Dee Williams as a leading man?
Could be.
What was the issue? How could they not find the script that you say 40 years later, you're still waiting for?
Well, I think they didn't know what to do with me. You know, I was something out of the ordinary. I presented a whole perspective and point of view that never really had that kind of impact as far as being a romantic figure on the screen. But And so they had no idea how to deal with that. They came up with ideas, but never really followed through with those ideas. So I always say you win some, you lose some.
Yeah, I love that even in your telling of it, there's no bitterness. I mean, you've had a fantastic life. What a journey. But it would be understandable if you would look back with a little bit of, what were you guys thinking? But I don't detect any bitterness, Billy, from you at all.
Well, I mean, listen, I'm not going to spend my life and my energy being pissed off. You know, it is what it is. But, I mean, I even had black executives decide that what I was presenting was not black enough. So, you know, you get it from both sides.
You know? That's interesting.
Which I always find really amusing.
Yeah, yeah. My mom and dad were married in the early 50s. My mom was Italian. And, you know, you talk about interracial relationships in the book, and, you know, I'm a product of one when interracial marriage was illegal, you know, in most states. And that not black enough, I can relate to that from both sides.
I'm sure you can.
Yeah. People look, they're like, what are you? That was my least favorite question growing up. Still is. I had a strong, strong relationship with my dad and followed in his footsteps professionally into the restaurant business. And I was really touched, Billy, by the closeness that you express to your whole family, your mom, your dad, your sister, Lady, your grandmother, but in particular, Hinako and Corey. And following in the footsteps of an icon has got to be a difficult path. And I wonder if you were ever concerned that the journey for Corey might be tough.
No. I've always encouraged Corey. Corey, he was my very first best friend. And we still remain best friends. I always made sure that Corey felt secure within himself. I always encouraged him. No matter what he decided to do, I was always 100% behind him and always pushing. I wanted him to always be cognizant of what he's able to present to the world. And so I've always been a real support to Corey. But I'm like that with my kids. I mean, and I don't, you know, I'm just daddy, you know, and we're all good buddies, and we love having great discussions with each other, you know, so that's pretty much the way we interact with each other.
Yeah, that's so rich. You know, there was one chapter in the book. It might have been the Mahogany premiere or Lady Sings the Blues. I think it was Mahogany, where you talk about having bought Corey a brown velvet suit. He looked like a movie star at the premiere. And I just love that you take the attention off yourself and you share the spotlight in such a gracious way. That really touched me.
You know, he was such a beautiful little boy, you know, and in a way, he was like having a nice little doll to play with, you know, dress up. I know that sounds a little bit peculiar, but. No, but I always, for me, Corey was just a beautiful little boy. I mean, it was a moment in my life when I thought that I would never ever want another child. I mean, he was like the best thing that ever happened to me. Before he was born, when I knew that he was, my wife was pregnant at the time, my first wife, Hurricane Audrey. you know, I kept saying my best friend is coming, and I was really, I was only 22 years old, 23, but I really looked forward to his entering the world.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that comes through in such a really warm way. You also talk a lot about your dad, and again, as the proud son, you know, that I am of my dad and what he was able to do. That relationship is, you know, it's so meaningful to me. And you talk about your dad as a hero in real life, and he worked maintenance and custodial work. And you said, quote, "The most important lesson in my life, I experienced how hard my father worked. You went to work for him one day in place of him, and you did his job, and you saw how hard he worked," and went on to say, "to work hard physically without complaints. a man of great character, an unconquerable soul. He taught me about humility, about devotion. He taught me about love. And Billy, you know, we're in a culture where we hear so much about toxic masculinity and the black father not being around, but we both come from, you know, strong father led households. Well, your mom had a big influence too, but I'm talking specifically here about the father-son bond. If you would just expand on that a little bit and the importance of fatherhood and sharing with your son the way that you have.
Daddy was he was from Texas. He was a big old country boy. And but the loveliest, sweetest, most wonderful human being. People loved him. And cuz he never put on airs. You know, he was always a very simple man. A man who didn't mind spending those long hours working to make sure everybody was okay. And he would always devote, you know, at least one day during the weekend, on the weekend, to all of us going out and doing something, like picnics. We'd go to Palisades Park, we'd go on to the beach, you know, Jones Beach or Orchard Beach. I mean, and also he loved cooking. So he would take a day and cook ham, turkey, beef, all of this stuff. And if you came to the house, you had to eat. And you know, and if before you left the house as a guest, he would kiss you on the forehead. Daddy was listen, when he was passing away from because he had leukemia. I was in California, and he waited for me to go back, fly back to New York City, where he was at Mount Sinai Hospital. And he was surrounded by all of the people that loved him, all of the people that he loved. And he was telling jokes as he was dying. His corny jokes. I remember one moment, beautiful moment, when he took my mother's hand and he held her hand and he said, "What's my little girl going to do without me?" Mm. And that was one of the most beautiful moments that I have ever experienced between two people. But Daddy, you know, when I took his job that summer, because he went and bought himself he never bought anything on time. If he couldn't afford it, he didn't buy it. But he saved up enough money to buy himself a 1956 Buick Special. And he hadn't seen his mother in 20 years. So he drove down to Texas in his car. But I stayed back and took on a couple of jobs that he did, maintenance jobs. And it was probably the best thing that ever happened to me. Because as you alluded to, it really made me realize a real sense of commitment, a real sense of love and commitment. Mm-hmm. And put himself through in order to keep his family together. So that was a great lesson for me. I think that kind of lesson creates a kind of a humility or an awareness of a kind of humility.
Yeah.
No matter what you achieve in life, it seemed to me, no matter what I would achieve in life, it humbled me.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Hey, I can see how it would be grounding, that kind of experience. And a couple things there, Billy, I wanted to go back and touch on. You know, one, where your dad, Pat, I was born at Mount Sinai Hospital. And it's funny, my parents, my mom was Italian. Her maiden name was Philomena Martha Noter Angelo. And because my dad was afraid that they could get arrested, you know, when they traveled outside of New York, filled in my birth certificate for my mom as Negro. I didn't realize that it was actually my father that had done that. But, you know, my father would,
I know.
He was from a different generation. And, you know, you mentioned the kiss on the forehead of your dad. As much as I love my dad, and we had many great conversations and talks, the most we ever did was shake hands. There was never, maybe we hugged one time. That's kind of like a light hug. But this on the forehead, I wanted to come back to that because in the book you share a moment when you went to visit the lady.
He will also give you a plunk on the head. That was
a little less pleasant.
Yeah.
But you went to visit the late, great Roscoe Lee Brown in his final days at Cedars-Sinai. I was also very close with Roscoe and visited him as well during his final days at Cedars. And Roscoe gave me a line, Billy, that has stayed with me. I think he might have seen me come in my dad's restaurant at one point, maybe a little too full of myself. And he pulled me aside, and it's become my mantra in the hospitality business. He said, "Young man, never mistake your arrival for the event." And man, that stayed with me. But I wanted to.
Great voice.
Great voice. I wanted to, you know, what I guess I'm trying to convey here is that there's importance here in the continuum of Black man to generationally to young Black men. And the stories like your stories, I'm so grateful that you've told yours because I feel like there's so many from a generation that have not been told and have not been told fully. And to have heard it in your words is just magnificent. And I hope that you appreciate the value that hearing the story in your words offers to a generation of younger Black men like myself.
Yeah, listen, if it helps, great. You know, fantastic. I think it's all about wonderful individuals. I tend not to gauge everything based on the question of Blackness. What's a good Black man as opposed to a Black man who's not a good father or whatever. Individual. I'm from that era of individualism, which I have a real appreciation for. And I tend to look at things pretty much based around that perspective.
Yeah. Okay.
No, listen. If it works, if I'm giving some piece of information that can be used, you know, listen. Great, fantastic. But I tend to look at life, I guess, pretty much based around, I guess, like when Tesla talks about frequency, energy, vibration. It's a kind of a universal kind of experience. It's experience of the universe. You know, when I pray to create creative energy in this life and beyond this life. Because I think that we're just an extension of something, a continuum. I'm still, even at this stage in my life, before I step out of here, I want to, you know, my sister and my mother were Jehovah Witness. They had an idea where they were going to go. I'm still trying to figure out something. And I hope before I have that moment that there's some part of me that knows where I'm going, whatever the hell I'm trying to say here.
No, I'm following you. I think, you know, you talk about that in the book. I think at one of your art exhibits, someone asked you about religion and, you know, if you believed in afterlife or whatever the question was. And your answer was along the lines of what you just said. And I think you used the expression, the eye of God, but you don't see God as an individual. But there's something out there.
Yeah,
in the universe.
I don't use the word God. I think that's all politics. Whatever the experience is, for me, is much bigger and much broader than just sort of locking into this kind of a temporal, myopic vision of that kind of energy. The energy is incredible, whatever it is. But I know that as long as I have breath, I'm going to try to... The brain is like a library for me. I'm going to try to do all of the things necessary. Oh boy, I hate getting into these kind of discussions. But anyway, I want to do the good things. I want to go through life doing this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's.
I want to finish with this.
Mm-hmm. Softly.
The conscious self.
Mm-hmm. Just going back just for a second to the role model, that if you don't mind that terminology, you know, just as you missed, Billy, the roles that could have been for you as a Black leading man, you talked about in the book, you know, where was our Ferris Bueller's Day Off? Where were, you know, so many of the stories and the nuances to our lives that could have been portrayed? To not have seen those examples on the screen, I think left a big vacancy for Black America. And so, you know, you represented something. You represented this elegance, this cool. I mean, if any one of us put on a new suit one day or would lean in too far in our car, I'd be like, oh, so what are you, Billy D today? You know, it's like you were this thing to us that raised the bar, that raised the standards. So I just wanted to make a point there that I get the removing of the color, you know, identification of race as any kind of a barrier or a restriction. But specifically for us, Billy, you were somebody that, you know, we saw ourselves in and who we wanted to be. So I just wanted to make that point a little bit clearer.
Well, I appreciate that. However, I see myself as a walking absurdity.
Walking, talking.
You know, it's very interesting. When I started really getting into my painting, I started out with, I consider my paintings self-portraits. No matter whatever I'm talking about. But I started out by painting about this myself as a journeying through life. And one of the first paintings I did after I came back from New York from doing fences, I remember was a painting, and I still have the painting. It's stored away. It's called From A to Z and Beyond. but it's a, I always saw myself as this kind of a, I love romance. I always saw myself as a kind of a, well, he ends up become what I call the bon vivant. But a guy who's just with a staff in his hand, journeying through life, going through, I guess, obfuscation. It's like journeying into areas that you can't figure out. So I have always, and then finally I ended up, the first paintings were me in a, walking through this storm with a staff in my hand and journeying to find out where I was going to go, you know, through all of these portals. I ended up with him being a bon vivant, you know, walking with his cane, you know, observing things as they exist and the absurdity of things. So anyway, I just thought I'd throw that out there. I'm still trying to figure it out, but I want to do it with a certain kind of elegance, because I love elegance. I'm from that school.
Well, dare I say you are accomplishing that as we speak. A couple things more, Billy, just before I let you go. I wanted to touch on friendship, because you said something interesting relative to James Baldwin, and you and him had developed a relationship very early on, and you talked about a time you went, took him to your tailor, and you he got a new suit tailor-made, and the broad grin on his face. We can all picture that smile on Baldwin's face. And, of course, you tried to develop the Malcolm X story with him, and, you know, that never came to be, unfortunately, for all of us who would have loved to have seen that. But the scene that struck me the most was when you were reacquainted with Baldwin after Lady Sings the Blues, and you talk about having grown up yourself and that the relationship had shifted. You were no longer the same, and I got the sense that the friendship, although there were still warm feelings there, the friendship wasn't what it was. And I'm curious about, I mean, I've heard it said that, you know, some friends are for a season. Do you feel that way, that there's such a thing as like seasonal friendship, where people are supposed to be in your lives for a certain period of time, and then, you know, you go one way, they go the other?
Well, yeah, I think that happens. You know, we were always friends, and we would always remain friends. It's just that I had a particular need to take a particular kind of direction, as opposed to Jimmy was a warrior. You know, Jimmy was he was battling. I'm not a person that likes to battle, but it somehow battling for him. It was beautiful to watch, and it was beautiful to listen to. I think I was a little bit more commercial-minded. I was looking to be a successful artist. It was, the ambition was, there were two different kinds of ambition. His was probably much more admirable than what I was searching for. I was searching to be one of the great actors in America. Things of that nature. I wanted to be a recognized painter. Yeah, that's pretty much it. It's like a marriage, right? You know, sometimes marriages go on forever, and then sometimes people just grow away from each other.
You use the expression that you were not recruitable. And I know that, you know, it was a time, obviously the 60s were turbulent, in some of the 70s. And that, you know, folks tried to get Billy Dee to join their cause, but you said you were not recruitable. I thought that was a real indication of knowing who you are, knowing who you were.
Well, I tried it. You know, it didn't work. I always found that whenever you join groups, everybody wants to be chief, you know, the boss. and I can't live in that kind of atmosphere. I'm first of all, I'm really a loner. As I said, I'm an individualist. So I live by the ideas based on that.
You're in your 80s now, Billy, and you still are strikingly handsome, debonair, well-dressed. You know, we're told to take kindly the counsel of the years and gracefully surrender the things of youth. And I'm wondering, with so much emphasis on physical beauty these days, aging for men can present its challenges. And for someone who has represented a certain physical aesthetic, as you have, how do you view the process of accepting what comes with age?
I don't know. Listen, you're just going to age no matter what. The process, I mean, I don't know if I have any control over that. I mean, I try to take as good care of myself. I don't know. I don't know how to answer that, really. I mean, I just try to do all of the things that keep good thoughts, surround myself with people that I care about and who care about me. You just take it from moment to moment, the day by day, and see where it all leads to. I'm still very much excited about life. And, you know, and I think as long as you have that, I'm still childlike in that sense. I mean, I will never give up wanting to know and wanting to listen.
In closing here, I savored the book like a great meal that you want to take a piece of bread and just, you know, sop up the gravy, you know, even at the end. And as I said to you, it stayed with me after. And you said towards the end, there were a lot of really great quotes, and I don't want to give them away because I want to encourage people to listen to it or read it for themselves. But, you know, something you said that was very simple, Billy, but I thought just like you, elegant and impactful. You said, quote, "Don't worry so much. Stay positive. Move forward. Enjoy life. It's a gift, an astonishing, beautiful, absurd gift. Be kind and be curious." And then my favorite part, chandelier, baby.
Chandelier.
Oh, that was great. That was great. Well, thank you, Billy, for taking some time today, man. I really appreciate it. It's a pleasure to meet you, and much respect for you, sir.
It's a pleasure meeting you, and stay well. Chandelier, baby. Ha ha.